Hello and welcome to PharmaLex Talks podcast. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Brad Carlin about Bayesian statistics and its increased ability to support decision making during clinical trials through incorporating auxiliary information. This, Brad explains, can not only enable time and cost savings for clinical studies, but can also reduce ethical risk by virtue of exposing fewer patients to an inferior treatment. Brad is Senior Advisor, Data Science and Statistics for PharmaLex, where he leverages his extensive experience as a statistical methodologist, data analyst, technical writer and instructor to incorporate Bayesian seamless design into their studies to better predict outcomes. Brad has spent many years in academia as a professor of statistics. He has published more than 175 papers in refereed books and journals, and indeed has co-authored on three Bayesian textbooks. Welcome to you, Brad, and thank you so much for taking the time to share your knowledge with our audience today.
Hello, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for the kind introduction.
You're welcome. So perhaps we can begin by briefly explaining to our audience what Bayesian thinking is in the context of clinical trial studies.
Sure. Well, Bayesian thinking is just an alternative to traditional frequentist statistical thinking, where we attempt to incorporate information we already know into a broader meta-analysis. During a clinical trial, we may be looking at incorporating historical information or disease registry data, or perhaps expert opinion, or even information we scoured off the internet. So there may be lots of sources of information that are of varying quality. Combining all the information in a principled way to get a better answer than a single trial could provide is the real value of Bayesian thinking. A secondary benefit is its ability to easily incorporate data-based adaptations into the trial design, say stopping the trial early because the drug is doing really great or because it's doing really poorly.
Very good. So perhaps you can explain what the benefits of Bayesian statistics in drug development, and in particular, let's look at why it's such a valuable approach for statistical inference.
Yes, well, drug development is a long, multi-phase process, and at every stage of that process, we want to predict how we're doing. How likely is it that we're going to get to the end of this process and successfully release and sell the drug? Bayes is really good at combining sources of information, accounting for their varying quality, and then giving you an accurate prediction in the face of all this uncertainty.
That being said, there are concerns and misconceptions about using Bayesian methods in inference. Why is that?
That's true. Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. First, there is concern that many statisticians at biopharma companies haven't had sufficient training in Bayesian inference, and so they're not in a good position to do this sort of work. In addition, regulators are worried that Bayesian methods might be misused, say, by incorporating only the auxiliary information that's favorable to the company's position. And then finally, because Bayesian methods require fairly sophisticated computing algorithms, regulators sometimes worry about being able to assess whether the applicant has done a good job or not. It's a more powerful but also more complicated approach than what they're used to, and so it's taking some time for Bayesian thinking to percolate into practice on both the applicant and the regulator sides. Happily, that is changing, and there's been a lot of recent encouragement from regulatory agencies to consider Bayesian methods, especially on the FDA's part, but also at other agencies, including the EMA.
Can we explore areas where regulators are more open to Bayesian thinking?
Surely. Well, there's a lot more encouragement by regulators for applicants to use Bayesian methods when developing complicated, maybe multi-phase studies where there are a lot of intermediate decisions to be made. For example, given the data we've seen so far, should we keep going? Should we drop a dose? Should we re-estimate the sample size? Change the randomization ratio? If you want to make an adaptive change to an active study, you almost have to use Bayesian methods because you need to account for all the different sources of uncertainty and predict what's likely to happen in the light of all the data. In fact, FDA has released a whole bunch of guidance documents about Bayesian methods, including for medical devices and for what they refer to as complex innovative designs, or CIDs. These essentially correspond to these new Bayesian adaptive designs. An FDA pilot meeting program now allows applicants to apply to submit a CID to regulators, who will then review it and grant two extra meetings to discuss the design with the applicant. At these meetings, the regulators will probably ask for more information, including the design's computer code, estimates of the trial's power and false positive rates, and various sensitivity analyses. All of this helps facilitate the use of Bayesian methods in these settings. If we go back to medical devices for a moment, one of the big differences between drugs and devices is that new drugs often don't have much in common with older ones, but that's typically not the case for established devices like a cardiac pacemaker. A new pacemaker's battery may be better, or it may be easier for the surgeon to implant underneath the pectoral muscle, but the way it keeps you alive is pretty much the same as the way the old pacemaker did. So combining information from historical data sets on older pacemakers is often less controversial in medical devices than it might be in drugs. One other area where regulators are open to Bayesian methods is in rare diseases, particularly pediatric rare diseases, because regulators are well aware that traditional clinical trial methods are often not feasible when the data are very scarce.
Let's go into this topic of rare diseases and Bayesian statistical borrowing methods more deeply. Why does this approach make sense in rare diseases, and how can it help to move research forward without placing undue stress on patient populations?
That's a great question. Rare disease is really the area where Bayes is having the biggest impact in biopharma. Regulators are aware that if the disease is rare, especially if it affects mostly children, as more than half of rare diseases do, traditionally you'd need a placebo or a standard of care group in a two-arm clinical trial. But many parents are not willing to participate in any study where their very sick child has a 50-50 chance of getting a sugar pill. You also can't do a traditional statistical approach with, say, 1,000 people in group one and 1,000 people in group two. In rare neurodegenerative diseases, for example, there might only be a couple of hundred people on the whole planet who have this disease. So traditional statistical methods are just not ethical or feasible in such settings. So that is where Bayes really comes to the fore, again, because it can borrow strength from other sources of data. For example, we might have natural history data on the kids that are in the study, which we can then use to have each patient serve as his or her own control. Alternatively, maybe we could dig out a historical data set of kids who got the standard of care in a previous study, and then try to imagine that these two separate data sets are really part of one big trial. Now, here there would be no randomization to treatment versus control, but there are still ways of getting around that statistically by coupling these Bayesian methods with causal inference tools, such as propensity score matching. This is an area where many regulators now recognize Bayes as a sensible way forward. Bayes is also often used in phase one oncology trials, where you have very ill patients who may have already failed on other medications. These studies are most likely single-arm studies with no placebo group at all. So that means you can't use traditional statistical methods, and you're going to have to rely on historical data or past patient data of some sort in order to make that efficacy comparison. And regulators are used to seeing Bayesian methods in phase one and even phase two oncology studies.
Thank you for that, Brad. You mentioned Bayesian statistical borrowing methods. Can you talk a little bit more about these, such as from historical data and external sources, where these are useful and where caution is required?
It's important to understand that the quality of the historical data can vary greatly. If you're borrowing information from the control group of a previous clinical trial that was run by your own company with the same enrollment rules, same inclusion and exclusion criteria and other characteristics as the study that you're planning, then you're more likely to be comfortable with borrowing strength from that historical data set. But if it's control data that you pulled out of a disease registry, then that data wasn't collected by the company, and it may have even come from a completely different country. So the nature of those patients might be quite different. How do we safely use that data set? There's a lot of debate on this point, but a lot of data scientists would say that they can derive a better estimate of treatment effect of the drug by using an enormous pile of messy real-world data than one could get from a carefully curated but much smaller, say, 100-person randomized data set. So real-world evidence is becoming more and more important in what we do to support decision-making. For example, in some early studies where you're mostly trying to decide internally whether or not to pursue development of a particular drug, you're free to use more sources of data to help you produce a better answer. Use of real-world evidence may produce a better answer about effectiveness, too, because in the real world, we know that patients don't look or behave like they do in clinical trials. So blending in real-world evidence might give us a better idea of how this drug is going to perform in real life. But we do need to use Bayes and other statistical methods to make up for that lack of clinical trial randomization to treatment and control.
So where does natural history data come into this in the context of Bayesian predictive distribution?
Well, natural history data is interesting because you may have trajectories of the patients over time. For example, maybe you're measuring some biomarker over time, and now you're going to give the patient some sort of intervention, and you're hoping to show that the patient improves once we give them the medication. If they do improve, it could still be just due to luck, right? It could be that something else happened when you intervened, and we can't check that without a placebo group. But at least every patient can act as his or her own control. We know when he or she got the intervention, so it's often reasonable to assume that if we see a change, it was probably due to the drug. Natural history data is becoming more available in rare diseases, in particular because many of these diseases have patient advocacy groups that collect valuable data on the patients. We're now even seeing partnerships between patient advocacy groups, rare disease-focused drug developers, and regulators. We still need rigorous statistical methods to evaluate the data, since the sources of data that we're collecting are less reliable now, and they're going to need a statistical adjustment before we can really use them sensibly.
What are the future opportunities for using Bayesian models in clinical trial designs and other studies?
The incorporation of real-world evidence is a really hot area right now. In rare diseases, regulators understand that there's often a significant unmet medical need, and it's important to get a beneficial medication out to the patient population as soon as possible. So they will sometimes grant conditional approval to drug developers, allowing them to replace traditional phase 3 studies with post-marketing data collection, keeping track of how the patients do, and eventually granting unconditional approval if all goes well. That's certainly an example of the benefit of utilizing real-world evidence. There are other examples of using real-world evidence that come earlier in the development process, even before we get to human testing. For example, a company may have done a lot of pharmacokinetic or pharmacodynamic work on a drug, and if another drug comes along in a similar class, and which is chemically similar to drugs we already know a lot about, they may allow you to use real-world evidence in place of starting all the PK and PD studies all over again. Other examples include adding new regulations to a drug's label or changing a drug's dosing regimen. In both cases, a regulator may, again, grant approval based on analysis of real-world evidence rather than requiring the company to conduct an entirely new trial from scratch. Bayesian methods are convenient for combining different sorts of information and making sense of complicated, messy data. For example, administrative data collected for billing purposes may provide some useful information. Pharmacy records can tell you what drugs the patient picked up, and medical records can tell you what medication the doctor prescribed. All these sources have information that's close to what we need to know, which is how much drug the patient actually took, but they're not exactly the same. Even that is changing thanks to information gathered by wearable medical devices that keep track of your pulse, your temperature, and so on, and in principle may be able to suggest changes in drug dosing. That's another big area for growth of Bayesian statistics, trying to incorporate yet another large source of data into the mix. So ultimately, Bayes is wonderful for coherently combining a bunch of disparate sources of information into a single summary to help you assess the effect of a drug on the patient. This can be done at the patient level, so it's an example of truly personalized medicine. Making sense of complex and disparate sources of patient-level information would be an unimaginably difficult problem without Bayesian statistics.
Brad, thank you so much for joining me today and for sharing your insights on Bayesian statistics. Thank you also to our listeners. I hope you take some valuable information from this episode and apply it in one way or another to your business. Please make sure you subscribe so that you can join us for future Formulex Talks podcasts.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I've enjoyed it.